Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
This hour, we're in-depth on what it means to live with terrorism.
The search is underway for those who are behind these evil acts. I've directed the full resources of our intelligence and law enforcement communities to find those responsible and to bring them to justice. We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
That's what the so-called War on Terror sounded like on the night of 9/11/2001. President Bush would go on to declare that the War on Terror wouldn't end until, quote, every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Today, on the eve of the 15th anniversary of 9/11, we're going to consider whether we've become a country that is learning to live with terrorism, as other countries must, and if we accept that, how does it influence our response, our international alliances, even our American identity? Two guests, a lot of experience on these issues, your thoughts too. What would it mean if instead of pretending that we can end all terrorism, we managed it like any other serious risk? What if we focused our resources more on resilience? What would that look like? Here's the number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Steph Curtis at nprnews.org/live. And I'm on Twitter, and I just tweeted out a question on this. It's at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Amos Giora, is a professor of law at the University of Utah and a former commander of the Israeli Defense Forces School of Military Law. And he joins us today from Salt Lake. And Amos, welcome. It's good to have you back on the show.
Kerry, as always, it's a great pleasure.
David Shanzer is with us. He's director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke, and with us today from Raleigh-Durham. And David, welcome to you. It's good to have you back on the show.
Well, I'm happy to be with you.
So, Amos, when President Bush vowed that night to stop and defeat every terrorist group of global reach, I wonder if you think in the moment most Americans believed that that would happen and had very little idea of what trying to execute that would mean.
So if I think back 15 years ago to that awful Tuesday morning and in the immediate aftermath of the attack and then President Bush's comments, I at the time was not living in the States. I at the time was serving in the Israel Defense Forces. But I would think that for the majority of the American public, the thought of an attack in New York and Washington and the final plane that went down was so overwhelming and so clearly out of the box in terms of any prior American experience with this thing called terrorism, that to what extent President Bush's words really sunk in and really resonated with the public, I think it's an open question. I think that the fact that the events were, for a majority of the public, were so overwhelming. Terrorism was so new at the time that I'm not really sure that the public fully understood what President Bush meant. And I'm not sure that President Bush, with all due respect, fully understood what terrorism, not at that moment, but terrorism, for instance, 15 years later, and if not 30 years later, what it really meant in terms of when he talked about bringing every terrorist to justice. The rhetoric is easy, but implementing it is a far different story, and comprehending and resonating in the context or in the immediate aftermath of a terrorist attack, especially for those who are not familiar with terrorism, I'm hard-pressed to believe that people really thought through exactly what President Bush's words meant.
Yeah, David, that was my next question, and Amos anticipated it. Did President Bush understand what he was really vowing to do, and did our other political leaders understand the implications of it the way they do today?
I don't think so. I think President Bush was doing what he needed to do as the leader of our country, not just as the commander-in-chief, not just as a strategist looking 15 years down the road, but showing strength, showing resolve, making people feel confident that their government was going to protect them. So I don't blame him for some verbal excesses in that regard, and that's what I think it is because, you know, we've had terrorism for centuries. We've had terrorism inside the United States, different form, not necessarily an international group invading and executing an attack. That's what was really unique about 9/11. So it was never realistic to say we were going to eliminate this scourge, because it's been with us forever, and it'll be with us as long as we have a world where there is political conflict and people who are dissatisfied and see no other pathway to change other than engaging in violence.
Okay.
And I think that will be for quite some time.
So then let me pick up on what you've both said, Amos, and come back to you and say, okay, we understand better what we're dealing with today. How do you think that we, before we get to this question about how we manage the risk of it, how do you think Americans view the threat of terrorism today in a way that may be different from that morning after September 11th?
So I think that question, Carrie, needs to be divided into two different parts. One, terrorism in the United States, and two, terrorism outside the United States. So as you and I have previously discussed, you know, open your internet and you'll see that there are terrorist attacks in Europe, unfortunately, on an increasingly common basis. And I think from the perspective of the American public, that has become, I don't want to use the expression everyday occurrence, but almost an everyday occurrence that does not really jar us the way it might have jarred us 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of terrorism in the United States, whether it's in Orlando or the attack in California or Fort Hood, Texas, I mean, you know, the list is longer than it used to be. I think there's maybe a temporary jar or jarring in terms of the American public. But it seems to me that over the course of the years, there's a greater acknowledgement that terrorism is the reality of our age. It doesn't mean that we accept it, but we recognize that it has become a part of contemporary life. And perhaps unlike the reaction to 9/11, which I think was probably shock that this has, you know, come to America, unlike Timothy McVeigh, which was homegrown, 9/11 is very different. I think over the course of the years, there's perhaps a greater maturity amongst the American public in recognizing that terrorism, both in the United States and outside the United States, is simply an unpleasant reality of the contemporary age.
Yeah, David, the reality of our age, as Amos says, how do you think Americans view that? And is that significantly different in the way that people in Western Europe and in the country that Amos is from view it?
I don't think we have nationally come to grips with the idea that a certain level of terrorism, even in our borders, is natural, the unavoidable. I think we still aspire and we still think that we can wall ourselves off from these problems, and that if our government is doing its job, it will stop, you know, as close to 100% of these types of incidents as possible. And, you know, I think part of that is that we've been a victim of our success, and that we rarely talk about, which is that if you woke up on September 12th and somebody told you in 15 years there won't be an attack even close to the magnitude of 9/11, all the incidents, the Al-Qaeda will not be able to execute an attack of any significant strength within our borders for 15 years, I think all the Americans would have taken that. I mean, we've had a very good result. It's very hard to stop lone gunmen from going into a nightclub and doing something horrible like they did in Orlando. But large-scale attack, we've stopped that. And so I think that's what people have come to expect.
And yet, David, I hear you on the acknowledgement that, you know, bombs have not blown up in Times Square. I mean, that kind of an attack was aborted, intervened on. But look at the reaction to a situation like San Bernardino. I don't know if Americans distinguish enough between the kind of attack, that would follow, that might follow 9/11, and these kind of individual attacks, or do they? What's your sense of that?
No, I agree with you 100% that these are, you know, horrible, tragic for the victims, but they don't threaten the core of our national life. They aren't really challenges to our way of governance. You know, we think of large-scale terrorist movements, and the reason we call it terrorism because they have some sort of political objective that they're trying to achieve. These attacks, these small-level attacks, haven't come close to shaking the foundations of our government yet. we seem to have a very visceral, hyperbolic reaction to these incidents. It changes our politics. It gathers huge, tremendous, over-the-top media coverage.
Right.
And I think it makes Americans more fearful than they both should and need to be.
Yeah, so Amos, that's exactly what I'm getting at, is what have we learned in the 15 years since, and why can David characterize them like that, hyperbolic, over-the-top, this perception that the whole core of what American democracy is under threat?
So I would suggest beginning with politics, which I was hoping not to bring into, but maybe there really is no choice, Carrie. So as I understand it, there's a presidential election in 2 months. And
yes, and Utah's a swing state, I hear. So
yes, it is. And I understand that one of the presidential candidates has promised to destroy, defeat ISIS within 30 days upon his election.
Donald Trump.
Well, you said it. The rhetoric is so overblown and so misleading and so awful, because no, we're not going to defeat and destroy ISIS within 30 days, whether he fires this general or fires that general. I mean, it's so extraordinarily irresponsible. It's staggering. The problem with it, from the perspective of the questions you're asking, is it creates a false expectation, a false illusion amongst X percentage of the American public that if we were to change presidents, then we could defeat ISIS, just like that. And that's just not a reality. And you hinted earlier that I live in Israel, and you know, we in Israel have been through this for decades. And I don't like the expression that we've learned to live with it, but we've learned to live with it. And maybe that is different from here in the United States in the context of hyperbole or hyperbolic rhetoric. I think politicians do an extraordinary disservice to the public when they engage in this hyperbolic rhetoric, because that's not effective, and it creates this false illusion that victory is right around the corner. Victory is not around the corner, and you've used the word a few minutes ago, I think, mitigate or manage, minimize terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you and I have talked about this before. I come from the school that says you cannot defeat terrorism. You can at best hope to mitigate it or manage it. But mitigating and managing in terms of the rhetoric of it doesn't sell as well as I'm going to destroy, defeat ISIS within 30 days of my assuming the presidency.
Yeah,
mitigating and managing is problematic to sell. But that's the responsible policy from my perspective in terms of explaining it to the public.
David, so I tweeted out a question on this in which I was implicating implying what Amos just said about mitigating and managing it, and the reaction is over the top. What surrender? What are you talking about? Are you kidding? I'd like your thoughts on what Amos is saying about we may not be able to talk about it in the political arena, but that is what we're talking about as far as living with terrorism and managing it like a risk, isn't it?
I think we can still talk about the groups that execute these attacks as enemies, and our desire to use sometimes military force against them. We have to try to damage them. It's not just politics and politicians, and with all due respect, Carrie, part of it is the media. You're trying to have a very mature conversation about this. I'm struck by, over 8 years almost, how President Obama has, in his approach to terrorism, often tried to, I think that the comment that was wrong, that ISIS was the JV team, kind of comes from this, where he tried to calm Americans, say, hey, this is not something to have a crisis about. We've got this after a number of different attacks, and the media and politics combined to push him to say, hey, you're not responding seriously enough. You're not taking this, you're not calming the fears of the American public. You need to do more, say more, seem more concerned. So I think it's partly the media affects politics very much as well, and how this phenomenon is covered. My feeling is that our media obsession with terrorism also makes these groups, it feeds into their own power. It makes them seem more powerful than they really are. And the touchstone of media should be accuracy.
I think a lot
of the coverage makes it inaccurate.
David, I really agree with that. And I don't see that the media coverage has matured much, to use your word, since 9/11. I mean, it's still breaking news. It's still endless cycles of hyperbolic analysis.
Listen, the media has a duty to cover what's happening, but I think it's the question of whether they move on a little more quickly and not try to explain the nature and not essentially have coverage that generates fear. Because actually, that's the terrorists' only strategic advantage, is that their activities gather this coverage and generate fear and actually possibly provoke countries, nations from doing things that they wouldn't otherwise do. And that's the real danger of terrorism.
This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, where we're asking a question about what we've learned about terrorism and not just who's behind it since 9/11. We know a lot about that. What we've learned about the idea of managing the risk. And I'm asking you, as David Shanzer joins us today from Duke and Amos Giora joins us from the University of Utah Law School, about what it would mean if instead of pretending that we could end all terrorism everywhere or even end all terrorism on American soil, that we managed it like any other serious risk. And note that word serious in my question. We're not taking this lightly, but we're talking about it in a different way than is common in the political arena. What if we focused resources on resilience? What would that look like? We're going to talk about that this hour. And I'd like your thoughts on this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieNPR, where Mark says, the commandant of the Marine Corps said we could pound ISIS into the ground like a tent stake. But then what? Years of occupation? Amos, are you as uncomfortable as David clearly is about the way ISIS and their goals and their contributions to terrorism are being talked about?
So, two answers. First of all, with respect to ISIS, it's hard to imagine a more barbaric and god-awful terrorist organization than ISIS that will do anything in order to achieve its aim, stated aim, of reestablishing or establishing the caliphate. It presents a very different kind of foe. I don't like the word foe, but foe than other groups in terms of their abilities, their capabilities, their resources, and again, their sheer barbarity. I mean, it's just unimaginable. But it needs to be, I think there are two answers. One, when the commandant of the Marine Corps says, what was the exact word, that we can pound them into the ground?
Yeah,
so
like
as
a
somebody
tent
who's,
stake.
Yeah, lovely. So as somebody who for years had a seat at the table of operational counterterrorism while serving in the Israel Defense Forces, I recoil at that kind of unnecessary verbiage and, again, hyperbolic rhetoric. It's a disservice. There's no reason to talk like that. It doesn't serve any purpose whatsoever. Your term about this understanding that a measured risk or a serious risk, that's correct. That rhetoric is just doesn't serve any purpose, not in terms of the soldiers, not in terms of the public, and not in terms of policymakers. And that then ties into your question about the media. You and your colleagues, Carrie, are in a bind. There's now a terrorist attack, and you have to get the hot news, the 24-hour cycle, and you have to be fast and you have to report quickly. That, unfortunately, does not allow many of your colleagues to engage in this kind of an in-depth conversation that you're having with David and myself this morning, because you have to be fast and you have to be, I don't like the word superficial, but superficial to get it out there. Mm-hmm. The more in-depth quality kinds of conversations where I think the public actually has the opportunity to learn, thanks to you and your questions, are unfortunately rare. And I think that in order to really understand terrorism, the history of terrorism, present-day terrorism, and the future of terrorism, the media needs to be much more attuned to its role as an educator that goes beyond merely reporting. And those who are in a position like the commandant of the Marine Corps, with all due respect to him, that kind of rhetoric just feeds right into that 24-hour news cycle. I can see the headline, Marine Corps Commandant Promises to Destroy ISIS. Trump promises to destroy ISIS. Everybody's promising. Full stop. David made a point that I think is very important about President Obama's referring to ISIS as the JV. For me, when he mentioned, when he made that comment, it highlighted, and I was concerned as to the quality of the intelligence information the president is receiving in terms of Middle East terrorism. Because he referred to them as JV, then it really shows a profound, at the time, on his part, a profound misunderstanding of the severity of the threat posed by ISIS. So the commandant of the Marine Corps, from my perspective, gets an F. President Obama, when he referred to the JV, ISIS as a JV, also receives an F.
Let me grab a call here from Will in Cambridge. Hi, Will. How are you thinking about this?
Oh, good morning. Well, I love seeing this kind of conversation because this is helpful. I wish the country sometimes would take a little more of an attitude of like terrorism being like a natural disaster. You know what? 100 people are killed in a national disaster. I mean, of course, it's terrible. But then if 100 people are killed in terrorism, it's almost like it's the end of our republic. I mean, just the difference in hysteria, you know, and they are profoundly different. I understand that. But just that change in attitude, I just think to talk about this is so helpful. And that disarms terrorists as much as anything.
Yeah, David, Will, thanks for the call. David, Stephen Flynn of Northeastern University has talked about this, actually specifically as to what our caller said, that we accept the risk of floods, we accept the risk of gun violence and car accidents. We're not happy about it. We're talking about how to stop it, but we do accept it as a serious risk to our society and to our, you know, organizations. Is that the kind of argument that you think might shift some of the thinking around terrorism and might shift the debate about it?
Well, I think that is the right thinking. I'm a big fan of Steve Flynn. I've met him and chatted with him many times. And, you know, people do get on television and explain that the risk of being in a terrorist incident inside the United States since 9/11 has been lower than drowning in your bathtub. But that doesn't seem to make a difference. Indeed, I start a lot of my classes here at Duke asking students, you know, that very hypothetical. I mean, here's a little piece of data for you. In the last month in the city of Chicago, there have been over 90 homicides in one city in one month.
Right.
Whereas nationally, the number of homicides connected to al-Qaeda and ISIS over the course of 15 years is just over 100, half of which happened in the Orlando shooting. So you can see the level of the risk is so much smaller than the things that we just live with every day, and they have a blip on and off the news, and we move on to something else. I wish we could have the same level of conversation maturity about that as we do on terrorism.
You know what's as you were just talking about that with Chicago, and I just read a big long piece, I think in the Times about it. There's this sense that we can't solve Chicago. You know, the problem is just so complex that it's almost impossible to solve that. And yet we don't take that same kind of attitude towards terrorism. Now, I'm not suggesting that average Americans say, well, it's easy to solve, just do this. But there seems to be this idea that when a political leader says, I can fix this, we want to believe that in a way that we don't believe something that's happening on the streets of an American city.
That's, you know, it's staggering and true because the Middle East, there's no other word to call it but a mess. And we somehow think about terrorism as a bunch of fanatical hooligans that have this finite set of, you know, who they are, where they are, and if we can just use our elements of force, our elements of governmental power to get them, remove them from the scene, that therefore that they'll be gone. But that shows such a lack of understanding because these people are motivated by a set of historical grievances. It's not about the last couple of years. It goes back literally decades and in some respects centuries. And the problem is the biggest tool to deal with this problem would be to have good governing states that can provide benefits and a good economy, education, security for their people. And the Middle East is so far away from the capability to do that, much further away than even it was back in 9/11, that those grievances, those things that generate dissatisfaction, political violence, are going to be with us. And therefore, if it's not the group that now calls itself ISIS, it'll be some other group that sees this ideology and says we have to try to take action into our own hands, and so there will continue to be this level of violence.
Amos, this is the what David's talking about is that glib, why do they hate us kind of question that drives me crazy. But I'm going to do this. I'm going to recommend Fareed Zakaria did a terrific program, an hour-long examination of that question, why do they hate us? And the answer is they don't, but there are some influences that you ought to be aware of. So I recommend that to our listeners from a couple of weeks ago. And what would you say to what David just suggested?
Well, I want to go back to Chicago for a second because I talked about that yesterday in class. If I am correct, neither presidential candidate has made much of an effort to address Chicago in his or her political statements.
That's right.
Unlike terrorism, in which they're only too happy to talk about without offering anything helpful. So you can talk about terrorism because it scores you points rhetorically on the campaign trail. Nobody wants to talk about Chicago because it's here and it raises very difficult and tragic questions. And I don't believe that either Secretary of State Clinton or Mr. Trump are happy to talk about Chicago. And that's unfortunate. In terms of the why do they hate us, which I agree with you, is a question that I find deeply troubling. First of all, the whole word they, anytime we talk about they, for me is very troubling because there's no they. There are those who are engaged in terrorism, and we need to focus on those who are engaged in terrorism, and that's narrowing the range as compared to the they, which is dangerous, very broad, and it's kind of this endless pit. In terms of, call it the rhetoric and what do we do moving forward, I recommend minimizing the rhetoric and focusing much more on identifying those who pose a threat, whether here in the United States or in the Middle East or any other region of the world, to how we define American national security, which is perhaps a different conversation. But if we're going to talk about managing terrorism or mitigating terrorism, it really does require us to articulate and define what's a threat, what's an immediate threat, what's a risk, what's a tolerable risk, and what's the extent to which we're willing to engage in operational measures with the understanding that when you engage in operational measures, you're hopefully going to be hitting those that you intend to hit and unfortunately also killing innocent civilians. And the question you have to ask yourself is, how much of that are you willing to tolerate? And at all times, asking yourself, how do you balance between legitimate national security considerations with equally legitimate civil rights and individual liberties? Those kinds of difficult questions and difficult answers, I think in terms of policymakers looking backwards and moving forwards, it's actually that kind of discussion that unfortunately, from my perspective, is oftentimes not held because it gives way, unfortunately, to the political rhetoric or the hyperbolic rhetoric that all three of us have been talking about.
Call here from Kate in Madison. Hi, Kate. I appreciate you waiting. What do you want to say?
Yeah. Carrie, the way that you posed your question actually highlights one of my main frustrations with the conversation surrounding terrorism, mm-hmm. is that we are forced to consider how we mitigate the effects of terrorism rather than putting resources towards, particularly in the United States, communities such as the Somali community that are isolated. And then thus more vulnerable to radicalization by ISIS. So what I'd like to hear your guests talk about, and I think they've done a little bit of this already, is, you know, to what extent can we talk about putting resources towards strengthening communities as opposed to combating the effects of community deficiencies?
It's a good point.
We have done to isolate them.
Yeah, it's a good point. It is why, Kate, I followed up that question about managing the risk with a question about what if we focused our resources on resilience? And that's something that we'll go into in further depth here on the other side of news. If you've just tuned in, it's a conversation about understanding better with a more nuanced approach to the threat of terrorism. What would it mean if instead of pretending that we can end all terrorism here and abroad? I mean, those were some of the claims that we heard in the early days after 9/11, they are still the claims that we hear, by the way, in a lot of the political debate in our political arena. What if we managed it like a serious risk? What if we focused more resources on resilience? This is something Israel has done. Amos will talk to us about that. David Shanzer will have some ideas about that from Duke, and I'm interested in your thoughts as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Give this a little thought. I'm seeing a little bit of knee-jerk reaction here on the phones and on Twitter. I'd like you to give yourself a minute to really think about this. What would resilience look like? And then I welcome your thoughts on this. We'll get a look at the latest news and we'll continue our conversations. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. President Obama says he's confident Americans will overwhelmingly reject Donald Trump on Election Day. Obama told reporters in Laos the GOP presidential candidate proves he isn't qualified to be president every time he speaks. Obama spoke as he closed out his final presidential trip to Asia. Last night, Trump criticized Obama's foreign policy decision, saying the president has left American generals reduced to rubble. A spokesman for President Vladimir Putin will not respond directly to Donald Trump's latest accolade for the Russian leader. Trump renewed his praise for Putin for having what he called great control over his country. Putin's spokesman says Moscow is willing to improve ties with the U.S. whether Trump or Hillary Clinton wins the presidential election. Russia's foreign ministry says Israeli and Palestinian leaders have agreed in principle to meet in Moscow for talks. It's not clear when that will happen. The comments indicated Russia is pushing forward with its efforts to host the meeting. Fewer Americans have been applying for unemployment benefits. It's another sign the U.S. job market remains healthy, despite a downshift in hiring in August. The Labor Department says the number of applications for jobless aid slid by 4,000 last week. Air China has removed copies of its in-flight magazine containing an article criticized as racist. The article said London was generally a safe place to travel, but urged precautions when visiting areas mainly populated by Indians, Pakistanis, and black people. And London Bridge may not be falling down, but the British Parliament is another story. A committee issues a report today on whether lawmakers will have to move out for several years to repair work at the Westminster. Westminster has collapsing roofs, crumbling walls, and leaking pipes. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
We're having a lot of conversations about politics and big issues ahead of the general election. If you can't listen in real time from 9 to 11, you can always find me on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes, right there for you anytime you're ready.
Programming is supported by MacPhail Music for Life, lessons designed for adults 55 plus, offering instrument and voice lessons for absolute beginner through experienced musician. Information and registration at MacPhail.org.
By the way, my Talking Volumes season opener, September 15th with Elizabeth Alexander. I can't wait. We've got Gloria Steinem and Ann Patchett. Yep, those shows are sold out. Carl Hiaasen not sold out yet. So tickets for the shows that you can get to on the thread, find it right there. Conversation today about terrorism. Amos Giora with us here from, he was a professor of law at the University of Utah, and David Shanzer with us, director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke. And to the phones to Susan in Bloomington. Hi, Susan. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. My question had to do with the media's role in trying to help people really assess the risk and looking at the facts, because we're far more likely to die. We're all afraid of course, dying or being killed by terrorism, yet there's a very, very small risk that that is going to happen to any of us in the United States. It's always big when it does, but the real risks at home are, you know, have to do more with what we eat, you know, getting cancer, heart disease, opioid addiction. I mean, we have all kinds of ways, right, that we're all going to go, but we never... You know, that's what frustrates me about the terrorism piece and the media. It's like, put the facts out there. That's the only way to counter fear is with good information, getting the facts out of how likely are these things going to happen to us, because that's how we decide where the resources go.
Susan, it's a cogent point, but David, I'm going to say this. There is a lot of excellent reporting on terrorism, long-form pieces in the New York Times and lots of other publications, shows like this. It doesn't seem to drown out the easy noise of you know, the extreme coverage around terrorism.
Well, you're right about that. And terrorism doesn't work in the sense that it doesn't really, hardly ever in history, the people who have engaged in it have brought about through their violence the change, the political change that they were seeking. But it does work in the sense that it is very effective at changing the conversation, at distorting reality. And unfortunately, that's a fact, you know, we just have to live with. The terrorism is an effective propaganda communications tool. And our modern technology, where there are, you know, fewer kind of authoritative media sources, and you have Twitter and social media constructing their own messages and sense of reality that people are absorbing, I think terrorism is really even more and more of an effective communication tool here in the social media age.
Amos, I want to talk about something that you wrote in July in the Times about resilience. You said, a mature, perhaps experienced is a better word, society understands that there will be days when terrorists have the upper hand in spite of government efforts. It also means that the most effective societal response to a terrorist attack is to continue living. Sitting at home with a woe-is-me attitude is giving in to terrorism. So how does Israel understand this idea of resilience?
So I wrote that piece sitting in my living room in our house outside Jerusalem. And reflecting back, I wrote it in aftermath, I don't remember which terrorist attack, perhaps in Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Reflecting back on my experience in the IDF and living in Israel. So anybody who's been to Israel, lives in Israel at the time of a terrorist attack, knows, has learned, that one of the things that we as Israelis are really good at is moving forward quickly. That's not being disrespectful to those who have died. It's not being disrespectful to the families that are suffering the loss of a loved one. But it does reflect the understanding that the best response that society can make to terrorism is that life is for the living. And to go out, you know, to coffee houses, go out to sporting events, go out wherever people go out. And the thought of staying at home and not getting out, from the perspective of terrorists, that's the victory from their perspective. And I really do believe that having been in Israel, you know, having lived there for the past 30 years, that the best response is to say, acknowledge that a terrorist attack has occurred, enable the security forces to do what they have to do, but for the public to gather itself and to go out as quickly as possible. One of the really interesting things to watch is to observe when in the news there's now a report about a suicide bombing, X number of people have been killed, and to watch reactions. And what I've observed over the years is that people have this mental, you know, like a Rolodex in their head. Do I know somebody who could have been there? Do I have friends who might have been there? And if the answer is no, you know, boom, you move on and you go on with your life. Because to approach terrorism intellectually, maybe perhaps existentially, any other way is, from my perspective, reflective of societal self-defeat. It gives the upper hand to terrorists. And there, as I wrote in the New York Times piece, there really is no better response than moving forward. I need to add that it was interesting to read the endless comments to the piece, some extremely critical that I think, I'm acquiescing to terrorism, I'm surrendering to terrorism.
Yep.
And then there are others who said, indeed, you know, it's correct. The best thing to do is to move ahead. There's no perfect answer here, but from the Israeli perspective and your use of the word resilience, again, life is for the living, and the best response to terrorism, and enable the security forces to do their bit, but live and show terrorism that they're not going to affect how we live in open societies.
Call here from Mark in Duluth. And Mark, you've been thinking about resilience?
Well, here's what resilience looks like to me. It means being inclusive instead of isolationist. It means curious instead of going for knee-jerk defensiveness. It means taking responsibility instead of blaming. And it means acting within the complexity of situations instead of oversimplifying just because we don't want to deal with the complexity. And that means we have a lot to learn. And I've heard several comments from both speakers about that, about a mature society instead of what I would characterize us as a naive society. We could be the shining example of living, but we're turning into hiding in our shell and giving up our rights. And it's not just terrorism. I think this is a microcosm that illustrates larger changes in our country. And we could be on the cusp of major change, given how many people seem to be spiraling into fear right now instead of love, curiosity, living their lives.
Mark, I really appreciate the call. David, what would you say about what Mark said?
Well, first of all, I agree. I don't think American society is that bad about moving on. I do think the media lingers. I wish our police would get in there, gather the evidence, clean up those scenes, and get that Pulse nightclub reopened as fast as possible. I think we could do a better job at that. But, you know, people go and they go to baseball games the next day. And, you know, I don't think it's quite as bad of a picture as Amos paints about American society. I'd like to point out another kind of corrosive aspect about the way we talk about terrorism. And it's always that if it occurs, that there was a failure by the police, failure by the FBI,
right.
And the politics, of course, always points you towards, as we said, blaming somebody for not preventing this. And it leads to this idea that our public institutions are ineffective, that they can't keep us safe. And to some extent, people say, well, they're corrupted or they're stupid. They don't even know how to deal with these problems. Why couldn't they deal with this? It should have been right in front of their face. And I think over a course, over and over and over, you know, in the end, these public institutions, the government is, you know, we have a democracy where these are reflections of us, we the people. And I think that's a very dangerous place to go because we need these public institutions to work, to function, to attract the best and the brightest people to come and work for them. And that's another reason I wish we could get out of the cycle of blame and failure that kind of pervades over our society like a cloud since 9/11. And I would say, hey, you know, FBI, Department of Homeland Security, CIA, 9/11 was horrible, big, terrible blow. But you've done a pretty darn good job in the past 15 years of preventing large-scale terrorist attacks in the United States. And that's something we should look back on and take with some pride on this anniversary instead of thinking how bad things are all the time.
David, the other thing I want to ask you and Amos about is what resilience looks like when it comes to our position geopolitically, globally. I mean, you know, often what happens if it's a threat from abroad, the way the United States then gets positioned in response doesn't seem to reflect a lot of what we're talking about this morning. I'd wonder about your thoughts on that. I don't want to keep talking. Go ahead.
I think we've actually achieved a bit more maturity, a bit more ability to talk about reasonable risk. If you compare, for example, our response to Iraq and believing that there was a terrorism threat emanating from Iraq and deciding that the United States needed to engage in a regime change to occupy the country for 8 years, to have over 100,000 troops and many other countries involved. And then we're looking at, I think we might have taken on too much risk by our desire in 2011 to have a total withdrawal so we could say that the war was over. And now we have ISIS, and I think we are taking a more measured approach. We aren't doing what the Marine Commandant said and trying to pound them like a tent peg because we know that the costs of that kind of strategy, because then we're there, we're in the middle of a civil war, we have no choice but to occupy the country and make sure the civilians there are safe. We're taking a more nuanced and measured approach. That feels very unsatisfying to many people because we're not eliminating the threat. We're not destroying the enemy. But so I think we are taking a more resilient, a more nuanced, risk-based approach to our counterterrorism abroad right now than we have in the past.
Okay. Well, Amos, what I was thinking of when I asked David about that is the reaction to Syrian immigrants and the way the United States positioned itself when other countries in Europe were saying, you know, we have to accept the risk. We need to be responding to this the way the United States responded to that.
So there are a number of different ways to look at, if you want to talk about the Syrian refugee. So the instinctual response for many of us is that a refugee in plight needs to be embraced and welcomed. That's the easy answer. The more complex question, and as you know, Carrie, I spend a lot of time in Europe, is that X percentage, and I don't know what the X is, but X percentage of the Syrian refugees are not exactly refugees, but are clearly plants by ISIS. I don't know the numbers, but it's a real concern, and that raises legitimate problematic questions about the vetting process. So I happen to believe that as the son of immigrants to America, that the refugee needs to be welcomed. But decision makers also have the obligation to protect the public by engaging in some kind of sophisticated, thorough vetting to ensure that the person who's requesting entrance is indeed a refugee and is not a plant by ISIS. It obviously slows down the process. It obviously raises difficult questions, but there needs to be some kind of a balancing there. Could the process be faster? The answer to that is yes. I was told yesterday that here in the United States, it takes between 24 to 27 months plus minus for the vetting process to be thorough.
And that was already in place. Again, I think the idea that of the ISIS plant was blown so far out of proportion that you heard it on the campaign trail, shut it all down.
Right. So I don't, the shutting it all down obviously doesn't work for me because, you know, I'm all about nuanced approaches and understanding the threats and understanding the opposite of threats. I understand that. But I do believe that there are legitimate national security considerations that need to be taken into consideration, full stop. But
I agree with
that.
Yeah, David, go ahead.
Just one more thought, David.
Okay.
Just one more thought.
Sorry.
That can't win out over the rhetorical hyperbolic way in which this issue has been spun by politicians that does a disservice. So yes, there's a need for balancing, totally, and I think it would behoove all of us. And maybe Carrie, in terms of reflection of 9/11, 15 years later, is to have a shift in how we address these very difficult questions to minimize the rhetoric and to be much more focused on practicality and nuance in an effort to strike a balance that I don't think we've done particularly well.
David?
Well, I think this just goes back to the kind of language we were talking about earlier in the program that with risk. And I agree with Amos 100% that the risk, that there is a risk. But I think what, for example, didn't come up as much in the debate is that of the Syrian refugees that we were actually rejecting a rate of 9 out of 10 of them for entry into the country. So there was a very serious vetting going on. Very fair question. Could it have been better? Were we pulling on the best sources? But in the end, we need to accept that no matter how extraordinary the process is, no government official, no government agency has a 100% accurate crystal ball. That the risk is small enough for us to accept, because to not feel and participate in trying to provide some form of help for the people, and it just brings me to heartache to think about the 400,000 people who have died, the 10 million people who are displaced, so many of them children who are losing their childhood because of this crisis. If we can't participate in providing some of them aid, then we're losing our humanity. And then again, you go back to what Amos was saying, that the terrorists have won because they've truly changed our society and what makes us human, what makes us a great and wonderful country.
Yeah, they've altered
that's always been part of us.
They've altered a core principle, right, of the American identity, if they succeed like that.
I agree, yes.
Call here from Brenda in Woodbury. Hi, Brenda. Thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Good morning, and thank you so much, Carrie, for having this topic and for your speaker's messages. And the reality in today's world is that very few people with financial resources can wreak havoc anywhere in the world. And our problem in America is that we believe the solution is military. And it's idiocy to think that we can eradicate terrorism, and the only ongoing solution is to use international efforts to help people in countries to succeed economically and humanitarianly so that they're not drawn into extremism or terrorism. And I'm concerned that today, you know, we don't fall into these traps. We jump into them. And I'm concerned that we're going to do it again.
Brenda, I appreciate the call. Thank you. And I want to hear from Paul here before we wrap up in Minneapolis. Hi, Paul. You're calling to say.
I just had a quick comment and was hoping to get your thoughts. You know, I'm wondering, when we take this back to the point you guys made about, you know, comparing this to Chicago and the feeling that we were so fearful of something like this, but not of the everyday things that happen in America. And I'm wondering if you think that it's not so much or as much a feeling of fear across the country, but more a feeling of just kind of sick and tired of this going on and their disregard for human life. And I just know personally that I have absolutely no fear of dying in terrorist attacks, but I'm definitely on board for the conversation being pushed because I'm just looking for this to kind of be ended, you know, if that makes
right.
sense.
Yeah, the fatigue of this. Amos, I have about 90 seconds left. Can you answer that?
Yeah, very quickly. I begin by suggesting to you and your listeners, Carrie, there's an outstanding article in this month's Atlantic Monthly about America today and America moving forward in terms of the world. It's a really interesting discussion.
Is that Steve Brills or...?
Led by, I think, Andrew Basovich.
Okay.
I think it's just it's well worth reading and well worth sharing with your readers. But it goes to the two previous questions. It is really asking America to where. It's a conversation that absolutely we must have. It is easier for many Americans and also for politicians to talk about America to where rather than talking about Chicago. It's an easier conversation for a variety of reasons. Both conversations need to be had. In terms of the question of terrorism, as I said earlier, it's here to stay. The question is, how do we deal with it? How do we perhaps mitigate it? How do we continue with this path of resilience with the understanding that there will be good days and there will be bad days? And even if when a terrorist attack occurs, it does not mean that the system has failed, but we just need to recognize that terrorism is here to stay, unfortunately.
Amos, I'm grateful for the time, as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
David, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Carrie, thanks for the opportunity.
The Climate Cast at the top of the 10 o'clock hour and the National Geographic photographer Annie Griffith. If you can't listen for the whole hour, you can find it on the podcast. You know where. NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes.